2 days in New York. Have we been hard on you?
I've been busy, but it's been pleasurable, too.
What are some of the things you've been doing?
Well, I've been talking to the media. I've been talking to Newsweek, various papers, radio. I've met a lot of people, been wined and dined, and seen a little bit of the sights of New York.
Is pocketbooks taking good care of you?
I think I could say they are, yes. Sigh of relief.
This is not your first trip to New York.
It is, it is. First time in New York, first time this side of the Atlantic.
Mm. Has it been a culture shock?
Well, it's... a lot of it is familiar in a sense, because in England we pick up on a lot of American things, but nonetheless it's a foreign country, I feel that. Here we are talking the same language, but it's foreign.
Yes, and New York is not representative of the rest of the United States.
I imagine that, yes.
I came from the Middle West, and I came directly to New York from Baltimore, where I worked for about 4 years before I was at school in the Middle West. So when I came to New York, one thing I noticed that many of the people, most of them, it seemed to me, didn't speak English. And they looked different, or they sounded... Even the English-speaking people in New York sounded different. Have you ever seen the Bugs Bunny cartoon?
Yes, yes. I know the voice you mean.
Bugs
yes.
Bunny has
yeah.
a Brooklyn accent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I found the accents very harsh and
right.
very difficult.
Yeah.
And I found people very abrupt. And it was the currency seemed different somehow. The prices were all out of line.
Mm-hmm.
Something, you go into a restaurant and I said, look at the menu and look at the prices. Yeah. This can't be right. They're three times what the
pay this
Kansas.
Much. Yeah.
And so I am not sure that New York is representative of the United States.
Yeah, I can see that's the case. You see, you're talking about meeting people who don't speak English in New York, but that, for us, makes perhaps New York more European. I've already met people who I've asked, are you from New York, here in New York? And they say, yes, I'm from New York. And then they add afterwards, well, actually, I'm from Poland or from Italy. And I mean, that whole background of people coming over from Europe possibly makes New York more like any European city than anywhere else in the States.
Pass a poster shop, you'll see them all over town, especially here in Midtown, and you'll see a New Yorker poster. It's a cover of New Yorker magazine, and it shows an elongated Manhattan.
All right.
And then you see the Hudson River, and then you see the rest of the country. It's as though the world were built around this one little island, a little tiny island. You can see across, you walk across it in 20 minutes, 20, 30 minutes. And yet New Yorkers have a warped perspective of the rest of the world. They don't see that there is a big nation beyond the Hudson, and they're not even sure there's very much across the Atlantic. Did you grow up in London or where?
Yes, I was born in London. Most of my life I'd spent in London except for student days. I was at Cambridge and at York. That's old York, not New York. And I spent a year or so abroad in Greece, otherwise in London.
They called York the White Rose City?
Yeah. Lancaster is Red Rose. Mm-hmm.
There's also a York, Pennsylvania, and a Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Right. Oh, I think all the British towns are represented over here somewhere or other. Mm-hmm. You've got a Manchester, Birmingham, everywhere.
You went to Cambridge. What did you study at Cambridge?
I studied English at Cambridge, and I went on to York to do postgraduate research. So that accounts for getting on for 6 years of my life. And then I got right away from academic things. It was really only at that point, after university, that I got down seriously to writing. I don't regret my university life because I think I read more at that time than I've ever done since, and that reading is obviously something that has influenced my writing.
Are you writing full-time?
I am now. when I started off, I was really in the position of teaching myself to write. I mean, I don't think I had a natural flair for it. I think it had to be worked at. And given that, and given that it's very difficult to be a young aspiring writer, I had to eat. I had to do something else. So I was a teacher on a kind of part-time basis. That's to say, when I started out, I was teaching more hours than a full-time teacher. And as my writing got into print, as I got more confident with it, I reduced the number of hours until finally, with Waterland, I took a complete break and gave up the teaching. I hope that will last. I mean, I don't think of myself as a teacher. I've no vocation as a teacher. I've always wanted to write, and I'm happy to say that I'm now a full-time writer. Very few writers in England are in that fortunate position. But it is an insecure occupation, and who knows if I'll have to go crawling back to the classroom.
What level were you teaching?
Well, I was teaching what we call O and A level. I don't know if that means anything over here. The kind of college, well, we call it a further education college. That means effectively that I was teaching young adults who had left school, but who had not passed exams at school and were coming back for a sort of second chance. Mostly people in their late teens, early 20s, but theoretically, and sometimes actually, people of 60 or more.
English?
Yeah, English.
Grammar?
Literature and grammar.
The story is in Learning to Swim, they're most winning. And as I was reading the stories, as I was reading the very first story in the book, Learning to Swim, title story in this volume, I was struck by how much you resembled the work of the American writer Raymond Carver. Mm-hmm. Do you know his work?
I don't. I've heard good things of him, but I haven't read a single piece by him.
Well, as soon as you leave here, you should head directly toward Doubleday or to Scribner's
and pick up
a copy of his short stories called Cathedral, his latest book.
Right.
There are tremendous similarities between your work and his. I was struck by these similarities. One of the chief similarities is the economy of your language. You do not waste words. In fact, your writing seems, I hate to say this, but it seems un-English.
I mean, you'll have to explain that.
I don't perceive of English writers writing in the style that you have adopted. Now, perhaps I'm wrong, because I obviously don't read every English writer there is. I just don't see English writers writing that way. Now, maybe this is my own lapse.
You're talking about economy of
the
language,
economy
concision.
The language that you are employing
yes.
in your work. Are there parallels to your work in England?
Well, I hope I'm my own man. I hope I'm individual. But I think I'm a little surprised by what you say. I mean, I would imagine that because I am English and have spent most of my life in London, that my style would have an English flavor. I'm trying to think of some other writers of short stories for comparison. Well, there's a short story writer called Ian McEwan.
I don't know if he's
heard of over here. I imagine he's published over here. He's a quite concise and economical writer. But the picture I'm getting is that your impression of English writing is of something more elaborate.
I probably should have not said that. I don't have a relation because I don't know that much. But I've been reading Richard Adams, for example.
Right.
It's not too applicable to what you write.
Right.
Dick France is a mystery writer who certainly does not write in the way you do in terms of content. But he's an economical writer. He's a newspaper person after he left the jockeying industry. So he does write in an economical sense. Bernice Rubens, I talked to her, now she...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go on. I really should... I've bit off more than I can chew because I don't have that much of an expertise mm-hmm. about British writers. But your work did strike me because it seems like a lot of the work that I am reading now in the United States, because a lot of people are mm-hmm. patterning their material after the style of Raymond Carver, who, by the way, has not written a novel.
He's right.
Poems. Yes. Have you written poetry, by the way?
I have, a long time ago, and I think it's best forgotten. I dabbled in poetry at a relative early age. To tell you the truth, I don't know. I mean, this is what I found out when I attempted to write poems, how poems are written. That's to say, certain very obvious technical things like where do you stop one line and start another are really not within my ken. I'd like to think that, well, I think that prose can become poetry. So I'd like to write the kind of prose which could now and then flower into something like poetry, rather than write poetry which descends into prose. But I've got no aspirations at the moment of writing poems.
Swift, your first novel was Waterland, which has just been published in paperback in the United States. Tell me how this... you were teaching at the time, I would imagine, that you began working on this novel. How did this come about?
Well, so far as I can keep tabs of it and remember, I'd say there were two stages. The first stage, as often happens at the beginning of things for me, is that some scene lodges itself in my mind and it won't go away, and it seems to imply other things. It seems to have potential. Now, how that exactly comes about is a total mystery. But in the case of Waterland, I did have this image of a drowned body and the body of a young boy, a teenager. And I had an image of this happening in a fairly remote situation, fairly remote country, and some time ago. Now, as I say, I can't explain why that got hold of me, but it did. And that certainly wasn't what got the novel going. It was just something that I had on ice. And the breakthrough, the thing which made the novel happen, was that I had the body and I had the various characters who discovered the body, including someone who I thought of as telling the story, who's the character Tom Crick in the novel, who's the same age as the boy who's died. And I wanted to come forward in time. The death occurs in wartime, in the 1940s. And I wanted to come forward and think of what happened to my narrator figure later in life. And it was the point where I made him a history teacher that things took off, because then I had not only a man in later life looking back on what proved to be a crucial moment in his early years and something which influenced the rest of his life, but I had a man who was interested in the past in a wider sense, history. And I was then, so I realized, writing a novel about ideas as much as about drama and plot and story. I mean, for me, the story is the most important thing. I see myself as a storyteller primarily. But Waterland certainly has a great deal to say about the phenomenon of history. And if one's going to deal with such a subject, you've got to deal with it from the point of view of some individual who would naturally be pretty obsessed by that subject. So it was a history teacher, really, that set the whole thing going.
Graham Swift in Shuttlecock, and in a number of the stories in Learning to Swim, there is a feeling, sort of an undercurrent of madness,
yeah,
and insanity. The, mm-hmm, the father in Shuttlecock, mm-hmm, of course, is in the hospital and does not speak. I'm not even sure about the narrator of the story.
Right, he's a little unstable, let's say, right.
In Learning to Swim, I have the feeling, well, in the the narrator of Hotel was in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
In the tunnel, I had this feeling here, a young couple in this abandoned building, looking, mm-hmm, out in this, I guess, a courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this feeling that something is wrong. What are they doing in this, mm-hmm, in this building?
Mm-hmm.
There are other examples as well. So I just wonder, why this apparent preoccupation with insanity that, mm-hmm, seems to be in your work?
Well, yeah, it's certainly there. I mean, I could add to your list. I mean, there is an asylum in Waterland, which figures now and then. Well, I suppose my answer would be that there's a lot of madness in the world. I mean, you only have to look at some of the things that happen in the world to see that the world is not an entirely rational place. And I think this element of irrationality, of insanity, madness at that extreme level, perhaps, ought to be faced. It ought to be explored. I think by exploring it, we learn about ourselves and we learn to control the irrational element in our behavior.
This is the same thesis that Gordon Lish, who's an editor at Knopf and a very skilled short story writer, who's published one short novel called Dear Mr. Capote and a collection of short stories not unlike your own. He had personal experience with insanity and usually writes from the viewpoint of one who has been insane.
Yeah.
Has insanity touched your life in any form?
Well, happily, I don't think I've ever, in the clinical sense, gone crazy. I've certainly been irrational in my time, but haven't we all? I did work once in a mental hospital when I was a student. I spent one summer working as a ward orderly in a hospital, and it was certainly one of the most educational experiences of my life to go into this other world, which was pretty enclosed, and to see the other side of experience.
More than educational, I would say. I think it somehow struck you emotionally.
I think it must have done, yes. And whilst it's true that I don't write generally in an autobiographical sense, I like to imagine and invent things. Certainly in Shuttlecock, where there is a character, the father of the narrator, who has experienced this extraordinary breakdown and no longer speaks and is indeed in a mental hospital. That hospital in the book is largely based on the one that I worked at, and the system, for example, of patients who are admitted as though in a couple of weeks they're going to be okay and they're going to leave, but they find themselves shifted along a series of wards which lead eventually in some cases to more or less permanent confinement. I mean, that was something that I saw and witnessed and was very disturbing. I don't think society, I don't know, I can't speak for over here in the States, but I don't think in England we have yet evolved a happy way of dealing with insanity, a happy way of integrating it into ordinary, so-called ordinary and normal society.
Well, our mental health experts, I put the term experts in quotation marks, feel that they have solved the problems here because we have miracle drugs. And so we give miracle drugs to insane people.
Mm-hmm.
And put them back out on the street.
Mm.
So you'll walk through the streets of New York City and you'll see people talking to themselves and defecating in the street and performing all sorts of bizarre acts. It's not illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Police will not arrest you just for being bizarre talking to yourself.
Right.
you didn't see this a number of years ago because people who talked to non-existent beings were taken
and put away.
You didn't see them, but now you'll go out and you'll see them. I don't know if this is the case in England.
Well, certainly the use of drugs is pretty widespread as a treatment. Drugs don't always cure. They just eliminate the symptoms. The problem is, it seems to me, that once the drugs or whatever treatment it is have done their immediate work and somebody's sent out into the world again, that there isn't sufficient aftercare. And to go back to this place where I worked, there were a good many patients who were admitted for treatment, went out again, and because they couldn't finally make that adjustment back to the normal so-called world, they voluntarily came back to the hospital. They chose to come back because it was a place they felt safe in, which is a very sad state of affairs.
When you were a child, growing up in London itself, is that correct?
That's right, in the suburbs of London, yeah.
What were your interests? Was there some inkling in your young childhood that you might someday write?
I would say that my ambition to write began when I was in my teens. But these things form maybe subconsciously at a very early age. I know that, you know, primary school, so I'm told because I can't remember this clearly, but I used to, my parents say that my teachers at primary school said I was particularly good at writing little stories even then. This is when I was about, I don't know, 9, 10, 11 years old. Certainly once the ambition had crystallized, I've never had any doubts about it. It's what I've always wanted to do.
Did you grow up in a bookish family?
I didn't, no. In my immediate family, certainly there's nobody else who is in the least bit literary. I was quite independent and original in that sense, although I would say that my parents never stood in my way about this ambition to write, as a lot of parents I think would, given that it's such an insecure course to pursue. But no, I can't find another artist figure in my family.
What has been the reaction of your parents to your work?
Well, they're certainly very happy now. Now things seem to be working out very well. I think it's true to say that they've never entirely understood my writing, my preoccupations in my writing, but they've always been very sympathetic to my doing it.
Do you know Martin Amis?
Well, I don't know him. I've met him. I've talked to him very briefly now and then.
I was talking to him last week. His father, as you know, is Kingsley Amis, and Kingsley Amis cannot stand Martin's work.
I know, yes.
Martin was saying that Kingsley likes stories that start out, there was a shot in the dark. Kingsley Amis thinks that Dick Francis is the greatest living writer in English today.
Oh, well, that I didn't know. But I certainly knew that there was this literary antagonism between the father and the son. I mean, it must be, in one sense, it's obviously a great advantage to be the writer son of another famous writer, but I think it's more a disadvantage because one has to prove that one is one's own man more.
That's terrible when you think about it, trying to follow in the footsteps of a famous writer.
Right.
Famous American writers, Howard Fast, whose son Jonathan Fast is trying to make it as a novelist, and he seems to have adapted well to being overshadowed. Susan Cheever, short story writer, father John Cheever's dead now.
Right.
She has written three novels now and a memoir about her father. And they seem to be doing okay, going out, writing completely different time. Right. Jonathan Fast writing science fiction.
Right.
Howard Fast, known primarily for his historical and generational book.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess if one tries to emulate the work of a parent, if he's going to follow in that field, he can be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
strike out, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. your own man. The Booker Prize, Bernice Rubens won that, I think, a year ago, and I see that you had been nominated for Booker Prize. That's a very valuable award to have in terms of book sales.
Mm-hmm. It is, yes. It's really the only institution of its kind that in England has some public impact on behalf of serious fiction. And over the last few years, last 4 or 5 years, it's become extremely influential. And all the British publishers get very worked up around autumn, fall, when the prize is announced, and they are, you know, very keen to get books shortlisted. To be even one of the nominated authors, I mean, let alone the recipient of the award, means a great deal in terms of public recognition and of sales in bookstores. It has its side that one could perhaps criticize, I mean, because it does select these 6 novels each year and give them a lot of attention. It means that a lot of other good books that are published at the time get overshadowed. But I think, in general, it has meant that now in England more people are reading good fiction than they did, let's say, 10 years ago. And fiction is having generally a kind of revival in Britain.
I wonder about the awards sometimes, any award, whether it's the American Book Award here or the Pulitzer Prize, because they do, as you mentioned, miss books. Joseph Hiller wrote a book called Catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
It gave a new phrase to the English language.
That's right.
The book came out in the early 1960s. It received a few reviews, but it was received poorly. Nobody bought the book to speak of. It languished for a couple of years. But gradually people began to buy it. It didn't quite go out of print,
mm-hmm.
especially people on college campuses. They began to buy it. And it's now a classic. But isn't that strange that here is a book that came out, nobody liked it. It was a piece of black humor. Nobody liked it. And it took some thinking to see where that book stood in relation to other books of its time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a movie will come out, a motion picture will come out, and nobody likes it, but it's revived, it comes back, it hangs in there. Or people like a movie that later seems to be superficial and doesn't seem to work. So I just wonder if time sometimes changes the way we look at literature in any kind of art.
Yeah, I think that it is the case that some books have to mature in their public recognition. It's funny, I was talking to my editor at Poseidon Press, Pocket Books, who was making, in a way, the same point as you've just made, that there are a number of books which are now quite successful, which, if you look back to the year they were published, really made no impression at all. I mean, the figures are very low. And yet, over a few years, they break through as quite important books. And I think, arguably, if that happens, then the likelihood of a continuing and permanent place for that book is stronger, rather more than the sort of overnight success kind of book, which then is forgotten.
By the same token, books are very ephemeral and very perishable. You cannot walk into a bookstore and expect to find anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Bookstores are highly selective in what they stock, and if you're looking for... Sometimes I will meet a writer, I'm enchanted by the writer, I want to find the earlier work.
Just can't, it's difficult to do.
You have to search it out. And even then they go out of print. And well, I could continue to talk to you on and on. You've given me 30 minutes of your time, and I really appreciate it. I am delighted to have been introduced by Pocket Books to your work, and I'm looking forward to working on this piece because I'd like to see a substantial American audience for it.
Thank you.
I certainly wish you the best, and hope you have a nice, safe visit here in New York, and maybe you'll get out to New Jersey before you leave.
Well, I'm going on to Boston, in fact. I'm going up there for 3 days before I go back to London. So we'll see another American city.
Boston, well, it's kind of like New York, but it's a lot smaller and lower.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nice town, and I think you'll like that.